My word. A panel game devised by Tony Schryan and Edward J. Mason. Dennis Powell and Frank Muir challenge Anne Scott James and Dennis Norton in a game about words. And here's your chairman, Jack Longland.
Well, we go straight into round one, which tests their vocabulary. For 2 marks, can you give me the meaning of the following words? We begin with Anne Scott James. Anne, your word is Quinsy, Q-U-I-N-S-Y.
Well, it's a disease.
Yes.
And it's a disease which, if you've taken a fertility pill, you... the thing that you produce comes out 5 times over and you get quintuplets. Which has been known to happen several times.
Would you sort of like to aim a little higher up?
Well, alternatively, I think I've got it now. Does my voice sound very broken and peculiar?
Rather sexy, I thought.
Just did you? I am charmed. Mm. It's a throat disease, I think.
Yes. What's it? Not normal modern name. It's quite simple, I think.
Laryngitis.
Oh, no, everything. Virus.
Oh, yes, that's right.
Modern name for everything.
Again, I think you've got
sprained
to go...
sprained ankles.
Just a tiny bit higher than the larynx.
The pharynx is higher than the
yes,
larynx.
Yes, and again. What do you have at the back of your throat?
Pharyngitis.
I've got a uvula. What have you got at the back of that?
Stick to that.
I didn't get the excessive.
Throatitis. It's a sore throat.
It'll do, I think. It's tonsillitis I was trying to get. It's a rather nasty kind, the suppurative tonsillitis. That's what Quinsy is nowadays normally called. And it comes from 2 Greek words. It means throttling a dog, is all I'll say. 2 marks. Thank you.
A debacle.
And now, Frank, your word is moratorium.
It's a sort of a crematorium with money. It means you put a clamp down.
Yes.
You bring things to a halt, as indeed happens at a crematorium. if in this program you ask us a question, ask me this question, and a male elephant on heat escaping from the zoo rampaged through here, and the men came with darts which put the thing to sleep and all this went on, a moratorium would be exercised on the question. In other words, you wouldn't expect me to answer until all this
that's
is over.
The least I should expect of you.
Moratorium is the same with money, with debts.
It's the debts I wanted. It's legal permission to defer for a stated or agreed time a payment of a debt or bond or other financial obligation. It's a Latin word from a source that means delay.
There's a lot of it about during the war.
A lot of it about during the war. But it can be a temporary ban on any activity, so Frank is quite right about that elephant of his. Now, Dennis Powell. Dennis, yours is orrery. O-R-R-E-R-Y. Orrery.
The title, the Duke of something an orrery.
Boyle's
orrery.
Cork.
No, cork and orrery.
You have a cork first, and then you have the orrery.
Boyle was the family name. And then
there was
cork. Well.
That's right. You're quite right, isn't it? But this isn't quite in fact. I don't want to...
Not what you want.
I don't want an earl.
No titles.
No, the title is connected with it, quite definitely, but I want an object other than an earl.
It's kind of astronomical object.
Yes, that's right.
It's the universe.
Yes, if
the world with sort of Saturn going round it and the moon going round us, everybody going round in mad circles.
All right, you're being Ptolemaic rather than Copernican, but I'll accept this. Too much. It's a clockwork mechanism. a clockwork mechanism which shows the movement of the heavenly bodies round the sun, not the earth. In other words, a model of the solar system, and it was invented in 1713, I think. And constructed for the Earl of Orrery, and it was named after him rather than the chap who built it. 2 marks. Dennis Norton. Analgesic.
Analgesic is
You could say that money is the best analgesic.
Yes, you could. It's
something that takes pain away.
Yes. Absolutely right. It's either a noun, a medicine, anodyne, that removes pain, or it can be an adjective tending to remove pain. 2 marks. And at this point, I give Dennis and Frank a quotation each to think about for their stories in the last round. And Dennis, yours is, coming events cast their shadows before. And for you, Frank, a jug of wine, a loaf of bread, and thou. Round 2 is a round of remarkable remarks, utterances uttered by well-known people at moments of fairly high drama. For 2 marks, who do you think might have said the following, and what was the dramatic occasion when it was said? Beginning with Anne Scott James, Pekavi, or if you prefer it, it can be Pekavi, P-E-C-C-A-V-I, Pekavi.
Oh, now, this was a secret message sent back from India to the Foreign Office in London. Pekavi being the Latin for I have sinned. And it therefore meant that who was it that captured sin?
General Napier had
captured the province of Sindh in India.
Yes, quite right. It was said, I think, by him first, being a sort of classical joker. And he then sent it as a one-word dispatch to the Foreign Office, which was enormously embarrassed, because it meant, in saying, I have sinned, it meant he'd fought the Battle of Hyderabad in 1843, and thereby had annexed the whole province of Sindh, which was not Her Majesty's government's intention at all. The cave I have sinned. Now, Frank Muir, by God, at this moment, I stand astonished by my own moderation.
This was a chap who was impeached, wasn't it?
Mm.
And in fact, he'd waxed most eloquent before then. So it was one of those sort of modest remarks made at the end of this thing.
Yes.
It's either Hastings or Clive.
Yes.
We think it was Clive.
Yes, you're absolutely right.
Clive of India.
Yes, he said it during a parliamentary inquiry into his alleged excesses and as a soldier and as an administrator in India, and it was in the House of Commons. I think you'll just get home to your 2 marks, because it might almost have been Warren Hastings as well. Dennis Powell, thy necessity is yet greater than mine.
Thy necessity? Oh, it's on a battlefield,
yes.
I think. Philip Sidney, yes.
Yes, and in what circumstances?
Well, he was sort of wounded and thirsty and a soldier.
Drummer boy. It's always a drummer boy.
was much thirstier and much more wounded. And so, as Philip Sidney said, you have the water.
Yes, and
though inferior in rank.
I think Frank was leading you towards Gunga Din, which would have been the wrong direction. At the Battle of Zutphen in 1586, Sir Philip Sidney was dying, in fact did die on the battlefield, and he said, give the water first to this desperately wounded soldier. He's a very considerable gentleman. 2 marks. Now, Dennis Norden. O diamond, diamond, thou little knowest the mischief done.
Sounds like Richard Burton looking in that dirty great ring. wasn't that, I don't know who it was, but it's something, somebody who'd written some work that he'd taken a long time over.
Yes.
And the dog, I won't venture to say how he'd ruined it. He ate it, let's say. He chewed it up or something like that. Who was it?
Was it John Stuart Mill?
No, I really don't know,
Jack. There were apples falling about as well.
Oh, was it Newton?
Yes.
Oh, I essayed levity and got gravity.
I think that was a rather direct help. I think it was giving 1.5 out of 2. Sir Isaac Newton said this, or was alleged to have said it, to his dog, who knocked over a candle, which in turn set fire to and destroyed the almost finished labours of some years of experiments and calculations. And it's in, curiously, in a footnote to a poem by a chap called Thomas Maud, who recounts this incident.
If he hadn't got on with the work, apples would still be falling up.
They were absolutely right. Yes, Einstein would have had nothing to do. A score at this stage, ladies and gentlemen, which is a very close one. Frank Muir and Dillis Power lead by one half of a mark. On our round of origins and derivations, and this time they can confer with each other openly because it's a team effort on each side. For 2 marks in this case, I want to know how these words or phrases originated or were derived. And Anne Scott James and Dennis Norden, yours is up the spout.
Come on, Norden, into battle.
What meaning are you going to essay for this? Because there's if you've got one up the spout, that can either be in the services, if your rifle was loaded, if you were if you were in the women's services. It was a rather easy way of getting demobbed. I don't know which of those two you want.
There was a particular, I think, Victorian sense in which this was used, and if you...
Would it be up the chimney? Would it be...
I think of three brass balls.
Oh, in the knocker shop. I mean, in the pawnbroker shop. It meant you got something in pock, is what I'm trying to say.
Yes.
That's what I wanted.
You have to take you on one side about that.
Yes, I do realise that. I hope this will be slightly...
The civilian use, up the spout, meant that you pawned something. And this was the bit between the front shop of the pawnbroker and his store at the back, and that was called the spout, or tube, through which your belongings passed, and you were lucky if you ever saw them again. So it goes up the spout, and it can only come down the spout when you've got enough money to redeem the pawn. But Dennis is quite right about up the spout with a rifle. The other one, I think, was a brilliant invention, but I'm not certain about that one. Well, Dennis Power, in fact, your word is skedaddle.
Well, let us leave this situation in which we're in as fast as possible.
Yes.
Yes.
Without necessarily considering anybody else.
Yes. Before we lose, yes.
Well, you have, in fact, answered, and I'm bound to give you your 2 marks, but it's usually said of troops or soldiers, male.
What, male?
It means decamping or retreating hastily in rout or fleeing. And it was used first by the Americans during the American Civil War, but it's quite probably deriving from a Scottish dialect verb, which meant that when you were carrying milk in a milk pail, you ran so fast that it spilled and slopped over.
No.
I think 2 is all right. Well, now we come to the last round, and we go back to those quotations I gave Frank and Dennis at the beginning of the program. And on this occasion, the marks will be awarded on the length of the applause from the audience here in the theatre. And if you remember, Dennis, your quotation is, "Coming events cast their shadows before," which I think is a proverb which is found in Campbell Lochiel's Warn in 1803.
Well, that phrase, word for word, exactly as you heard it, without one syllable altered or twisted, that phrase was the scathing retort I made at the age of 17 to Trent Nugent, who was the artistic director, juvenile lead and theatre lessee of the Willesden Thespians. Now, I must explain that I had joined the Willesden Thespians for only one reason, because at the age of 17, I had extremely sticking out ears. And I mean extremely. With my flat cap on, the silhouette of my head resembled nothing so much as an Austin 7 with the 2 side doors open. Which, of course, made me extremely diffident with girls. And that actually was what made me join the Willesden Thespians, because among young men of that day, there was a very widely held theory that the best possible way to get girls flocking to you was to be the star in an amateur dramatic society. And of all our local amateur dramatic societies, the
thespians attracted by far the largest female following. Now, this wasn't so much because of the quality of their plays or the standard of their acting. It was due practically completely to the fact that the bloke who printed their posters was a little on the short-sighted side. And this was demonstrated by the enormous crowds that rushed to see their production of Patrick Hamilton's play Rope. And it was a similar error which brought the house full notices out for Ivor Novello's Careless Rapture. But as I say, when I joined them for their winter season, my purpose was quite cold-blooded, to work my way up through the company till I could take the starring role in The Desert Song. I went along at the beginning of the season and presented myself to Trent Nugent. Now, there was an insufferable character. Trent was actually in the society more or less all-powerful, and accordingly it was to him I explained that I wanted to end the season as the Red Shadow, but until then I was perfectly willing to work my way up to it. All right, very well, he said. In our first production, we'll just give you a walk-on part. Now, that expression, a walk-on part, I took to be the customary theatrical jargon until I saw what the first production was, The Bridge of San Luis Rey. And I was to be the bridge. apparently some altercation with the scenery builders, which meant that I spent the major part of Thornton Wilder's great work stretched out between two papier-mâché rocks with handrails attached either side of me being walked on. Nevertheless, I did feel that I'd served the necessary apprenticeship, so when we finally came to the first read-through of The Desert Song, I thrust myself in front of the company and, without prompting, I recited the whole of the Red Shadow part, chucked in a snatch of One Alone to Call My Own, say nothing of two choruses of the Riff Song. Well, when the rest of the cast broke into spontaneous applause, I could tell that Trent Nugent was really impressed. He said, "That was very good. Very good." He said, "I think," and he handed me a script, "I think you've earned this." And when I looked down at the part circled for me, my gorge leapt. I was third sand dune. I said to him, "Wait a minute. What about the Red Shadow?" He said, "I'm terribly sorry," he said, "but that's quite out of the question. You see, I was cast for that before the season even opened." Well, that was where I made that aforementioned retort. "In that case," I said, "this amateur dramatic society shouldn't call themselves the Wilsdon Thespians. They should call themselves the Coming Events." He said, "Why?" I said, "Because," I said, without altering or twisting a syllable, I said, "it's coming events cast their shadows before."
A lurid glimpse into Dennis's past. And we go on now to Frank Muir, and if you remember, his quotation was, "A jug of wine, a loaf of bread, and thou."
"I've been asked by the vicar to give some advice on young men about to be married. Now, in 1848, Punch's advice to young men about to be married was don't. But I don't agree with this. I think young men should get married. But if I had to choose one piece of advice, gentlemen, I would say this, that when you get married, you'll find that women have an eccentric attitude towards personal hygiene. women expect one to bath more than once a month. Now, this I totally and absolutely disagree with. I think it's unhealthy and dangerous. The history of baths is rather interesting. Well, it's not very interesting, but I won't go into a lot of historical detail, and bore you. I don't know, I might as well. Baths really came from the Persians, like a lot of things, like polo and cats and markets and carpets. The Persians invented mixed bathing. They had men and women in the same bath. The next you hear of it, it popped up in Greece with Archimedes. Archimedes was in the habit of filling his bath right up to the rim and then leaping in. And this slopped all over the bathroom, which eventually led him to measure the amount of water which slopped over, which he discovered equaled his own weight. So he discovered this principle that a body displaces its own weight in water. And also it made the towel so wet that when he chucked it on the bath rail, it pulled the nails out and the bath rail fell off. So he invented the screw. Bathing really started in England, in Cornwall, and there they used to bath in the spring. Now we bath like, or women would have you bath, every night. And this can be very dangerous. Now your skin, gentlemen, before you get married, your skin is really like a ferile sweater which covers you in its entirety. It has essential oils in it. It's like a sort of knitted garment keeping your bones from sticking out. And it's sort of edged round with lips to stop your mouth from fraying. And it's got sort of embroidery on top where your hair is. But essentially, it's a living, breathing thing full of oil. Now, if you rub over this rancid oil and acid boiled up into a cake, you destroy all these waxes and oils. And just like a farewell thing, and the air can get in, and you know, your ribs will rust. What you need to do is this, gentlemen. Once a month, when your wife is out, strip naked, stand in the bath, and dab yourself lightly with rainwater. It is pure water. Just stick a jug under the drain pipe of the down pipe of the gutter and keep it ready. Dab yourself lightly over your salient features with a little bit of cotton wool moistened with rainwater. Now, anything like sort of mud or axle grease that you've got onto, you scrub vigorously with a dry loofah. Not damp, but dry. That will get off all the rough stuff, you see. And then, just to tone up your whole system and get all the sort of dirty marks off, rub yourself with a circular motion with half a stale loaf. Bread is terribly good for absorbing grease, and you can use it for rubbing up pencil. Rub yourself all over, and this will dry off the rainwater and will tone up your whole system. So what I'm saying, gentlemen, my one piece of advice I can give to you to about to be married is don't go in for this awful pagan bath rubbish. Let's go back to Persia and go back to the words of that marvellous old woman who made the outsized tents, old Ma Cohen. What you need, all nature needs to see a perfect, clean and fragrant body is a jug of rain, a loofah, bread and thou.
I don't know what the shade of Omar Khayyam would think about that one. But by your vote, ladies and gentlemen, Frank Muir wins the contest of the stories, and he and Dilys Powell also, on this evening, win the entire contest.
My word, you heard Dilys Powell, Anne Scott James, Frank Muir and Dennis Norden introduced by Jack Longland, with questions compiled by Peter Moore. The program was devised by Tony Shryan and Edward J. Mason and presented by the BBC.